This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
AFL-CIO restructuring equal revitalizing the labor movement? Does it? With Stanley Aronowitz, professor of sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center. The AFL-CIO Executive Council meetings in Las Vegas will endorse a sweeping restructuring of the Labor Federation in order to reverse the decline of unions and the labor movement. But Aronowitz argues that the model of social movement unionism is missing an ingredient in various prescriptions for addressing labor's decline. And the real question becomes, is it form over substance? Well, we'll find out with Professor Stanley Aronowitz.
Stanley, welcome to Building Bridges.
Thanks very much, Ken.
Both Mimi and I have questions as to the relevance of their proposals. What's your reactions to what they're proposing to do?
They're going to make financial and organizational proposals. They're going to put more money into organizing. They're going to make, I think, pious declarations about how it's important that affiliates do organizing. They may even urge affiliates to merge to accommodate to the proposal of the new union partnership, which is now dissolved but is very much alive in the person of President of the Service Employees, Andy Stern, John Wilhelm, and Bruce Rayner of the Unite Here group. And they're going to be trying to smooth out the differences between John Sweeney, who was pretty much committed to doing politics rather than organizing after the failure of their earlier program of 1995 when he got elected, and Stern and company, who really want to shift the emphasis of the union movement to organizing. The problem is, for all of them, are we going to rely on full-time organizers? They're going to put money into more staff. They're going to put a token amount of money into the Walmart situation where they've been getting their backsides beaten in. And I don't think that's the direction that they ought to be going.
Well, what is to be done?
Well, my view is that they've got to start a big campaign, yeah. But it has to be a campaign that, if they're going to do anything at all, mobilizes their own rank and file. There are still 13 million members of the AFL-CIO. Most of these unions have not called upon them to join the organizing effort. Most of these unions have not fought for a more militant stance at the shop floor level. Most of these unions have recruited people to support what I consider to be a failed effort to revitalize the Democratic Party. And what's really missing at this point is a social movement model, which really says, look, this labor movement is going to revive only when the rank and file takes the scales of off their eyes and decides that they're going to take power in the union movement. And that's what they're not going to do. And so I think the problem is, how do you get these people to move? And I think the historical record is that they only move when there are challenges to their own leadership from people who are at the bottom, who say, look, you're not serving our interests. We've got to go in a different direction. We're going to take initiative. That's what I think has to happen.
But Stanley, that's generic. It's generalized. The question really is, why haven't workers within these structures been mobilized? Is it about union democracy or the lack thereof? Is it about disenfranchisement of workers of African ancestry that has been historic within the labor movement? Or is it that business unionism has just eclipsed the nascent activity and activism that spurred forth the growth of the labor movement, or something entirely different?
No, I think it's all of the above. But I think the problem is, Mimi, that when you turn members into clients and they look upon their union as they would look upon Metropolitan Life Insurance Company or Prudential or Cigna or one of those insurance companies where they get benefits, then you don't expect them to take to heart the problem of what it means to revitalize a movement. In fact, the concept of movement is not on the lips of either the leaders or the members right now. It's also that there is very little union democracy. Every time a rank-and-file group gets together and tries to change the union, the leadership comes down like a ton of bricks. We do have union caucuses, in the Teamsters Union, in our own union, that is my own union, the Professional Staff Congress, in the Carpenters Union now there's a national caucus, there's a caucus in the International Longshoremen's Association. These caucuses may be the hope of the labor movement, but there aren't enough of them because many of the members have lost hope that their unions really represent something different in American society that's going to meet their interests. So that union democracy is one issue, and there are people like the Association of Union Democracy that have been making heroic efforts, in my opinion, to try to change that situation. But what is true is that these people who run the labor movement today don't any longer have the instinct to even save themselves. That's what's so sad. They're not people who will be able to take the kinds of initiatives that will change the environment for labor organizing. Let me give you one example. They spend $200 million to support this candidate of the Democratic Party for president, John Kerry. Well, you could do with $200 million, you could have a national labor daily. I mean, a printed newspaper. You could buy radio stations. You could sponsor television programs. You could bring labor's message. Even with this leadership, they've got a message that's inherent in the labor movement to the general public and to non-union people and say, look, we're your defenders. And when the Enron situation takes place, when the WorldCom situation takes place and pensions are basically stolen and health benefits are robbed, the labor movement does not say, let's call a national day of protest. The labor movement, as it presently exists, the leadership of the AFL-CIO, or for that matter, the people who are fighting the leadership of the AFL-CIO from within, like Andy Stern, don't say, this is a time for something unusual. So that you've got to begin to see that the changes are not going to take place primarily from within. I'm from an inside strategy. I think it's good. I think caucuses have to try to change their own unions. But there has to be an outside strategy as well. Members who are activists like you and me have to say, okay, you're not going to take initiative. We're going to start taking initiative. And I want to give you one example. It's not a big example, but it's an important one. The Killer Coke campaign of the corporate campaign, which is led by Ray Rogers and his friends, have made Coke a major issue on college campuses because they have been killing labor activists in places like Columbia. It's not the answer, but it is an initiative that basically says we're not going to let an American company kill labor activists. We're not going to let, or we could say the same thing about Walmart, we're not going to let Walmart impoverish their own workers so that they can charge cheaper prices in the stores. But they got to do this on a much more public basis. It can't be the union organizing campaign as we know it. And I think that's half the problem. They have no imagination left. They're more interested in their own leadership than they are in revitalizing the labor movement. And I think until there's a basic change, until they take all that money out of political electoral activity and put it back into movement building, I think we're going to be in some serious trouble. Otherwise, we're going to have to start all over again.
The percentage of workers in unions has plunged to 12.5%. from nearly 35% in the 1950s. What should the issues be as we continue to lose vast numbers of people in an organized collective bargaining format in the labor movement? How do you define the issues? What do we look at?
I think there's been too much emphasis on the losses of membership proportion to the labor force, although that's a serious problem, and I don't want to underestimate it. I think the major problem with the unions today is that many of them find themselves in a situation where they cannot genuinely improve the wages and the benefits of their own members. Collective bargaining has become collective begging. In many public employees' unions, which are now a very large part of the membership of the American labor movement, they face, especially in New York State, laws which prohibit them from striking on penalty of fines and even imprisonment. But they've taken that law in New York State called the Taylor Law very seriously, and for many years now we haven't had strikes to get better working conditions and better wages. In fact, the District Council 37 contracts, which cover about 125,000 people, were settled below inflation rate in New York City. Inflation rate's 3.8% or 3.5%, depending on how you look at it. And they settled for about 2% a year over 3 years because they are not prepared to take on Mayor Bloomberg and the city administration. And this is going on across the country. Of course, there are real problems in manufacturing because every time a real struggle takes place in manufacturing, the company threatens to move, and many times they do move. But the American labor movement is, in some sense, seriously demobilized to even benefit their own members. So what happens is unorganized workers, non-union workers, facing their own employer, say, can this union really support me if I stick my neck out? And in many cases, they find out that the union can't or won't. The union movement was once a movement that really protected individuals as well as protected collectivities of workers against discriminatory discharge, against wage cuts, against benefit cuts, but now they can't do that. When the Enron scandal, for example, took place, and the company actually took billions of dollars of workers' pension funds, those employees did not look to unions to defend them. In fact, you know, the AFL-CIO made a statement, but it didn't go out and organize a campaign against the wholesale theft of pension funds, which is not only taking place in non-union workplaces, but it's taking place in union workplaces. The airline industry now has gone to court to get courts to say, no, you don't have to pay your pension, you don't have to pay your health benefits to workers, even though it's a contract. So when unorganized workers look at this, when Walmart workers, for example, look at this kind of record and this quietude by the union movement against employers taking advantage of workers and really exploiting them in ways that we haven't seen for 60 years, they say, why should I join this union? I would like to have a union. I'd like to have a union which is a fighting organization, which is really going to take on the boss. And they find that in many cases, that's not what's happening. Unions, in many respects, are rolling over. And I think that's the major problem. I don't think in organizing, but I also think it's the major problem in the decline of union power to defend and extend working people's needs and conditions. So I think the organizational proposals of consolidating 60 unions into 12 or 20, as Andy Stern and others have suggested, of putting more money into organizing, are really not getting at the real problem. The problem is that the union movement has to regain its militancy, has to regain its fighting spirit, has to really become anti-capitalist. And if it doesn't become anti-capitalist, that is really take the position that bad laws and bad bosses are not to be respected, then I think they're going to continue to go into history and they're going to continue to decline until a new movement arises. The trouble is that there are many in the union movement in a position of leadership who recognize the crisis, but their solutions are all organizational. They're not rallying their members to take on the bosses. Let me give you an example in New York City. Half of the city contracts, the United Federation of Teachers contract, the police and fire contract, the contract of us at City University, we have 20,000 people represented in our contract. Half of those contracts haven't been settled. The unions are holding out for better than 2% a year or 1% a year. In some cases, by the way, there is no raises in given years, even though the inflation rate is, as I say, 3.5%. But nobody has seriously suggested united action, ranging from mass demonstrations at City Hall, job actions, even to a strike. Nobody has suggested that this might be the real answer to the gridlock that's taken place in collective bargaining, even though those unions will not agree to do the kind of what I consider to be concessionary bargaining. What companies, as well as the city administration in New York City, are asking is that workers give up time, give up the idea that people start at the same rate. In the case of the DC 37 settlement, new employees will start at 15% lower than the starting rate of others. You're getting in many industries, two-tier, three-tier, four-tier systems. And they're not saying, look, we're not going to go for this. We're going to have to make a stand. But it seems to me that the labor movement today has no line in the sand over which they will fight. And as long as they do that, they're going to continue to decline.
Stanley, historically speaking, when were the times and what were the conditions? I know this is a very long discussion, but we're going to have to condense it for this show. When unions grew and what are the conditions that did that?
Well, the last time, I don't mean the last time, but the best time that it was when something really new happened is when the AFL was basically on its back in the 1920s and the early 30s, and radicals of various kinds got together and said, we're not going to let the labor movement die because these leaders, including John Lewis, we're not going to let them kill the labor movement out of their own lethargy and also their own protection of their own leaders. So the Trade Union Education League, which was largely organized by the Communist Party, and the miners' movement, which was largely not a communist movement in the mining industry, people got together and said, look, we're going to take on the task of organizing. We're going to take on the basic task of rebuilding the labor movement. And in fact, between 1922 and basically 1934, most of the real activity that took place outside of the AFL, and new unions sprang up, and sometimes internal caucuses within the unions sprang up, but there were associations of militants, of activists, who took leadership. Then again, it began to happen again in the 1960s and 70s, and I would call the attention of everybody to the Teamsters for Democratic Union, the New Directions Caucus and the TWU in the 70s and 80s, and other caucuses began to re-raise the issue, does this leadership represent us, or the Miners for Democracy, under Jablonski, who got killed, and the Miners Union became a much more democratic union because it took rank-and-file people to say, we're not going to let this union go the way of the corruption of a guy who ran the miners' union named Tony Boyle. So we had this again beginning in the late 60s through the beginning of the new century, 2000. And there were certain kinds of activity, but that activity was not largely sponsored by the established leadership of the AFL-CIO. It was sponsored basically by people who were at the bottom. And I think we're going to have to see that again before this union movement is going to be revived.
One of the exciting things that, of course, happened during the 60s, also in the labor movement, was the rank-and-file caucuses such as DRUM,
right.
Detroit Revolutionary Union Movement, which sprung up, and people relating to issues where they lived as well as within the workplace and seeing that bridge, if you will, that needed to be built. And, of course, workers' centers springing up. So the whole methodology seems to be stagnant and static. And indeed, the discourse in Las Vegas seems that it will be more of a procedural rather than a substantive nature.
I agree with you. And, you know, I'm sorry, Mimi, that I didn't mention DRUM and the Dodge Revolutionary Movement, the Ford Revolutionary Movement, those people who organized in the late 60s, General Baker and so on, and said, look, we want skilled jobs. We want even managerial jobs. We're black, and we've been excluded, and we're not going to sit still for this anymore. That was a very important movement, and I think that has been beautifully done by a book called I Do Mind Dying by Marvin Serkin and by Dan Giagakis, which has been reissued, and I think everybody should read that because it's a kind of a model. In addition to Teamsters for Democratic Union and others, it's a kind of a model which says, look, we're not waiting for you to liberate us. We're going to take the action on our own. And I think that's what we have to begin to see as a model for the future. Because that's a model of social union labor movement, not a model of organizing and organizing essentially from the top.
I think also with the 60s, the confluence of the civil rights movement and the labor movement, massive organizing, not only in Memphis, Tennessee, in the sanitation workers' strike, but massive organizing of government workers, federal workers, public, state, county, municipal workers in that period as part of the social movement. So what do you mean by social movement unionism?
Well, what I mean in the very first place, is that it's a democratic union that is not only for, but also of and by the rank and file. That's the first thing. The second thing is, and Mimi said this beautifully, and I want to just repeat it and elaborate a little bit, is that it has to say, look, if there is a Metropolitan Council on Housing, of which I was the organizing vice president in the 60s, by the way, when we organized the rent strikes, workers don't simply live in the shop, they also live in the community. And in the community, they face exorbitant rents, they face schools that are falling apart for their kids, they face asthma because of the pollution in the environment. And the labor movement is a social movement when it takes on the questions their members face in the neighborhoods and face in education and housing and in the environment and other kinds of issues. That's what a labor movement would be. And it's a labor movement that doesn't only think that its main job is to be a business that delivers higher wages and better working conditions and pensions, but also takes on every aspect of their own members' lives as well as the lives of the working class. That's what a social movement is. And social movement unionism is really about taking a class approach to the problems of labor. And the labor movement does not take a class approach when it essentially presents itself as an insurance company and presents itself as a business that helps people just get a few bucks more.
Now, of course, the AFL-CIO, particularly in recent years, actually it's been a lot of recent years, has looked to the electoral arena and as a kind of collateral reality of that to issues of being unable to organize or an unreceptive National Labor Relations Board. What is wrong with, what is a problematic within the way organized labor works in the electoral arena?
Well, the first problem is that the electoral arena that they're working in doesn't belong to them, and they're not representing themselves as an independent force in that arena. I happen to believe that, especially at the local level, there ought to be a labor party. I believe in the labor party at the national level, but I think the initiatives could be taken in places like New York and Los Angeles and Detroit and Chicago and St. Louis at the local level to break with a democratic machine which, to a large extent, has failed to take up the issues that workers really face. But even after having said that, which independent politics is important, the second problem is that they're putting all of their efforts, they're transferring their energies from building the movement itself to supporting democratic politicians on the basis of the fact that they think that the Democratic Party is going to deliver labor law reform. I don't think that the National Labor Relations Act, and this is my opinion, you know, I'm not saying this is everybody's opinion, but the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which finally got legalized in 1938 when the court decided that it was legal in the chicken pluckers case, that the National Labor Relations Act has been largely in the best interest of working people. In any case, even if you don't agree with that point of view, you look at court decisions, and increasingly the NLRA and the National Labor Relations Board, which administers it, have been institutions which have protected employers. They've allowed them to go to district court to delay and delay and delay elections. They've given employers free speech to oppose the union and to threaten workers with plant removal or job loss when they decide to organize. The National Labor Relations Act also made it almost a historical relic, the fight to win recognition through strikes. We lost our ability to think of ourselves as people who will actually take action, direct action, job actions, and strike actions. Instead, we were trained, we were conditioned, we were habituated to going to elections, to believing that the employer will live within the framework of a contract, and for a while that did work, in fact. But now we are in a period of American history when the employer regards any contract as legal within business, as respected. The only contract that is no longer respected, and never really was respected unless people fought, is the union contract. The union contract does not have the status, it may formally have the status of law, but from the employer's point of view, it is not anything that they will respect unless workers actually fight to enforce it.
And how hard is it, and how do you begin to win economic strikes as that Damoclean sword is hung over workers that says they will be driven to the bankruptcy courts, or they will be driven out of the country should they in any way exercise, assuming they even have and haven't bargained it away in their contract, a right to strike?
It's a very good point. I will give you the example of Argentina. when these companies abandoned the plants because of the Argentine economic crisis, some workers decided that they will not simply let those plants stay idle and they will accept their situation passively. They occupied the plants and began to actually operate the plants. In 1930s, in the United States, there were sit-down strikes. People occupied the plants for recognition, but they never really occupied the plants after those factories got abandoned. We had 1 million workers in New York City in factories, and now we have less than 200,000. We have 150,000. We don't have a culture which says we won't let these employers decide whether we're going to have a job or not a job. We're going to take responsibility on our own. I know this is very difficult, and I know that people got threatened, they got terrorized, and I use the word terrorized advisedly given our current situation, by the fact that employers were able to intimidate them. Nobody ever said, and I'm saying this organized way, I'm not saying individuals, nobody ever said, we will not let this plant shut down, we will not let this workplace go someplace else. And it's I want to give you an example that is right from yesterday's news. Do our listeners know, many of whom of us who are members of TIAA CREF, which is a teacher's pension plan, that our teacher's pension plan, which is nonprofit, has moved from New York City substantially to Charlotte, North Carolina? And the reason that they moved was because of cost benefit. That is to say, they're paying lower wages and have lower costs in Charlotte, North Carolina than New York City. I went up to that office in on Madison Avenue, and I discovered empty desks because they had moved away from that office, and they had basically outsourced the jobs of New York City workers elsewhere.
Well, Stanley, we're going to have to leave it there, and I would encourage our listeners to get Just Around the Corner, The Paradox of the Jobless Economy.
Recovery,
and I dare say that there are many other books in the offing, and it's been a pleasure speaking with Professor Stanley Aronowitz, Professor of Sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center.
Thank you.
And this has been Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Tune in next week.